Good morning, friends of my heart. Today's reading is from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 6, 20 through 25. That's on page 164 in the Pew Bible, if you'd like to follow. When your children ask you in time to come, "What is the meaning of decrees and the statutes and the ordinances that the Lord our God has commanded you?" Then you shall say to your children, "We were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. The Lord displayed before our eyes great and awesome signs and wonders against Egypt, against Pharaoh, and all his household. He brought us out from there in order to bring us in, to give us the land that he promised on oath to our ancestors. Then the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our lasting good, so as to keep us alive, as is now the case. If we diligently observe this entire commandment before the Lord our God, as he has commanded us, we will be in the right."
Good morning, Reedwood family. Today, the agenda has four items. So I want to start with a small confession. I've been working for the Jesuits now for 31 years, so I'm getting used to hearing about confessions. Then I want to move to a startling proposal, then go to a shocking series of biblical meditations, and then finally end with what I hope is a helpful set of conclusions. That's quite an agenda. We better get started. Now, here's my little confession. I love museums. Portland has a few good ones. London is chock-a-block with them. Don't you love that Australian saying, chock-a-block? They've shortened it now to chuckers. Los Angeles, well, we're getting better. We're slowly getting over Los Angeles's horrendously well-deserved reputation for trashing its past, like yesterday's McDonald's wrappers. What is a museum for, brothers and sisters? Quiet afternoons, strolling it, looking at pictures or objects? Or are museums a place for reconsidering the past? Could a museum be a place for serious discussions about our traditions? Could a museum even be a place to help us think about the future? Well, that's my little confession that I love museums. Now here comes part two, the shocking proposal. Now, for some of you who don't know who Arthur Roberts was. Arthur Roberts was a beloved friend of this meeting. He was for many years, a professor at George Fox University in Newburgh. And for those of you who don't call up an image right away when you hear the name Arthur Roberts, let me just explain that he was about the closest thing that Newburgh produced to Obi-Wan Kenobi, and perhaps Leo Tolstoy rolled into one. So with that kind of background, here comes my perhaps slightly shocking proposal. I am about to disagree with Arthur Roberts. Now, I know I'm going to give some of you time to catch your breath here. So, with a legacy like that, how dare I take issue with the master? Well, before you pack me up and send me back to my Jesuit employers in Los Angeles, let's talk about this for a minute. I once proposed, as a naive fourth-year student at George Fox, I once proposed that Newburgh should have a Quaker museum. See, at the time, it was my hope that a museum might remind young Quakers about their heritage as Quakers, and perhaps encourage some of us to reconsider what I still believe on the part of a good number of our yearly meeting in the mid-20th century to have been, quite frankly, a rather wholesale abandonment of a lot of our Quaker traditions. Perhaps a museum might serve to remind some of us, no, there's some important things that we should reconsider. And I remember the comment he made, like it was yesterday. He hesitated not a second and said, "You build museums when your movement's dead." I was humbled to silence. But over the years, I've had many occasions to go back over that exchange, as brief as it was, to reconsider it, to rethink it, and finally to arrive at the conclusion that I'm presenting to you now this morning. Dare I say it, my brothers and sisters, I think dear Arthur was wrong. You see, there can be radically different ideas, of course, what a museum is for. Arthur, I suspect, was thinking about museums as places for depositing old stuff in order for historians to come along later and write about it. Dusty, quiet, ultimately lifeless, because the objects once had life but don't anymore, rather like a cemetery. But the word itself, museum, has kind of a radical idea. It comes from the Greek idea of sacred spirits that inspired artists and writers and philosophers, the muses. So it was a place to reconnect with the muses, to be inspired, a place to live and to create. You see, for Arthur and I, our hearts were not united on what a museum is and what it's for. For Arthur, who was quite a historian after all, a museum was a place to keep the accomplishments of the past for the writers of history. He seemed to imagine history writers, perhaps, as hopeful thinking obituary writers. But I thought of this Quaker Museum in radically different terms. I wanted something that confronted us with vibrant truths, with a living tradition, and even the occasional mistake. Now let me walk you into the entrance of my Quaker Museum. Here we are, here's our first display. It's an old black hat. It's not much to look at. But why is it here? It's here because there was a day when all Quaker men wore these black hats all the time. And they refused to take them off unless they were praying to God. Now, why is that such a radical thing? Because the idea in the day when this began, the idea was when a Quaker male confronts another male who is of higher status, you are supposed to doff your hat. You are supposed to remove your hat in recognition. Ah, this man is higher than me. For example, appearing before a judge. So it's not the hat, brothers and sisters. It's what it meant. Let's go to the next display. Here is rather impressive dress. Gray. Rather nice, made of nice material, but it's terribly dirty along the bottom of the dress. That's interesting. Let's take a look at what the display says. The dress of Elizabeth Fry. Well, that's interesting. Elizabeth Fry, you see, was an early Quaker reformer who wore proper dresses, but the reason that it's dirty around the bottom is that Elizabeth Fry would visit the prisons, somewhere where no woman of proper society should ever be thinking of, much less visiting on a regular basis. So just as it's not the hat, it's what it meant, it's not the dress, it's where it's been. It's where it was willing to go for the sake of remembering those who were forgotten, for the sake of caring for those who were forgotten. Well, let's move on. Let's see, we're going through another doorway here. This one's got an interesting sign on the top. It says, "The Hall of Mistakes." Hey, this is a big room. There's a whole wing. What's going on here? Why in the world would a museum have a whole wing for mistakes, wrong turns? And why is that wing so big? Because our museum, my brothers and sisters, would be very much like our Bible. And now, 2.3, the shocking biblical reflections. In fact, my friends, biblical study should always be shocking, or it's lousy Bible study. Now, the Bible, as we know, has a good deal of history. But biblical history is not what we think typical history writing is about. You see, here's what's interesting about biblical history writing. It's filled with judgments and hard reflections on the past. Now, we know, to give us a little context, that the greatest challenge that ever faced the kingdom of Judah occurred about 600 years before the birth of Jesus. The larger kingdom of Israel faced its greatest challenge 100 years before, but our Bibles are very focused on Judah and its capital, Jerusalem, so we'll dwell on this one. 600 years before the birth of Jesus, from southern Mesopotamia came the Babylonian Empire. They surrounded Jerusalem. Jerusalem surrendered. King Nebuchadnezzar took a large number of prisoners of war. He force-marched them from what is today Jerusalem, through what is today Syria, through northern Mesopotamia, and forcibly resettled them in what is today southern Iraq. It was the greatest crisis and the greatest challenge that the biblical people ever faced. It changed everything. Because from that moment, from those events, the biblical people were never again in control of their own destinies. They always lived under occupation or foreign exile. How could they be the people of God with no land, no army, no king, a temple that was a smoking ruin in gutted Jerusalem? Jerusalem's walls were so devastated by this event that over 150 years later, Nehemiah famously took his nighttime horseback ride to inspect the destruction of the walls of Jerusalem. They were still all over the place. Now, what's the point of this little background? The point, of course, is that a good amount of the history writing of the Bible was written in the shadow of those horrific events. The main history books of the Old Testament, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, these six books, since the 1940s, we have come to understand that these six books are not, in fact, six different books. In fact, they are part 1, part 2, part 3, part 4, part 5, and part 6 of one long narrative that starts at the entry into the land with Joshua and finishes, well, now that's interesting. What is the last event mentioned at the end of this long historical narrative? That very exile I just described, the conquest by the Babylonians. What does that mean? That means, brothers and sisters, that the entire history from Joshua coming into the land all the way to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, that entire history has been finished for us by exiles, by the conquered, by the devastated. And that's why it reads the way it does. And how does it read? Oh, you read Roman history. And how do the Romans write their history? Our mighty armies we conquered. How do the Greeks write their history? 300 of us held off the whole Persian Empire. I mean, they're proud of their history. How do the Hebrews write their history? Oh, we made a mistake here. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, that was a bad mistake. Oh, look at that. Oh, that was awful. Oh, look at that. Oh, that king did all those horrible things. Look, oh, that was terrible. That's how the entire history reads. Brothers and sisters, here's the interesting thing about the Hebrews and how they wrote their history. It's a catalog of our mistakes. Because one of the reasons why it is written that way is because the exiles are sitting in Babylon or in the smoking ruin of Jerusalem, and they are asking themselves one central question: how did we get here? And so the history writers of Scripture decided, that's a very intriguing question. Let's just think about how we got here. We knew better, but did this. We knew better, but did that. We knew better, but did this. We knew better, but did that. And what is the this and that? Every king of the Bible, except one, is trashed. And they sinned as their father sinned before them. The only king, by the way, is not David. Ooh, David gets serious bad press in the Bible. I mean, we know about as much about the mistakes of Donald Trump as we know about the mistakes of King David. And they are extensive in both cases. 1 Samuel 8 even declares the whole idea of asking for a king was a horrible mistake. The prophets over and over again declared to a people who simply would not listen that temple worship was becoming economically corrupt, religiously useless, that Amos even has God saying, I don't want to listen to your hymns anymore. Do justice. Jeremiah, to an unthinking audience, proclaimed that what God really cares about is the widow, the orphan, and the foreigner. That is, the most vulnerable of Israelite society. We could go over this. The point simply is, for the Hebrew history writers, history was a shocking review of mistakes. Truth be told, the wing of our Bible museum dedicated to mistakes, frankly, dwarfs the rest of the entire museum. It seems clear that what has happened in the exile is that they are thinking, we got ourselves into this mess. Now, one of the ways in which we know the impact of the Bible Museum is because of a prayer that began to be traditional in the decades and then centuries after that exile. It turns up in three places in the Common Bible, and the Catholics get to read a few more books, and so they get one more example of this same prayer. It's called the penitential prayer, and it's the same prayer over and over again. There's one in Daniel 9, there's one in Ezra 9, there's one in Nehemiah 9, and there's one in a very interesting book called Baruch, chapters 1 and 2. Listen to how this prayer goes in the example from Daniel. He says, I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, O Lord God, great and awesome God, keeping covenant and steadfast love with those who love you and keep your commandments. We have sinned and done wrong. We have acted wickedly and rebelled. We are turning aside from your commandments and ordinances. We have not listened to your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings, our princes, our ancestors, and all the people of the land. Righteousness is on your side, O Lord, but open shame falls on us, the people of Judah, the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Open shame, O Lord, falls on us, our kings, our officials, our ancestors, because we have sinned against you. We have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God by following his laws, which he set before us by his servants, the prophets. That prayer is said over and over again over a number of hundreds of years. From the time that they were exiled from Jerusalem right up to the time of Jesus, there are versions of that prayer over and over again. Now, why? I don't think the point was to feel guilty. I think the point was to remind themselves, we don't want to go down that road again. Been there, done that, didn't work. Do the people of Jesus need to be reminded on a regular basis of where we've been and don't want to go again? Or to put it another way, do the people of Jesus need to visit that wing of the museum that talks about our wrong turns? Brothers and sisters, there are Christians who want to be powerful. They want to lord it over others. They want people to kneel at their demands. These are Christians who are constantly trying to embroider David on red hats. to make the powerful David the center of their theology and mighty and often ruthless king at the center of their plans for the future. And by doing so, they want to studiously avoid that wing of the biblical museum. I don't think that those prayers were there to make people feel bad. It was a warning. Don't go that way again. For those who called on Jesus to be the new David, Jesus' response was quite interesting, wasn't it? There were those of his disciples that still assumed that he was going to come to power like David, to be the ruthless king that David clearly was. And so when Jesus came to his power, they said, "Jesus, let us be at your right and at your left." In other words, they want front row seats at the massacre of Romans. But Jesus called to them and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. It will not be so among you. Whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave, just as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve." Jesus was not David. Jesus was the king David never was. Jesus was not the ruler, the murderer, the schemer, the abuser. No. Jesus was the servant king, moved by compassion at the calls and the needs of the actual people. But Scripture is constantly reminding us of those temptations like the old way. We read the Bible in order to resist the temptations to power. We read the Bible in order to resist the temptations for greed. We read the Bible in order to resist the temptations to bigotry and selfishness. We read the Bible in order to resist the temptations to greatness defined as anything other than servanthood. Brothers and sisters, we know that Quakers traditionally have a profound vision for the joyful kingdom of Christ. But we also have a tradition of reminding ourselves and our fellow Americans, of genocidal violence against the indigenous of this land, of reminding ourselves and our fellow Americans of the suppression, at times violent suppression, of women, to remind ourselves and our fellow Americans of the horrendous violence against African Americans, to remind ourselves and our fellow Americans of this incessant drive for wars and more wars. We insist on these reminders. We insist on these walks through that wing of the museum, not because we hate America. That is a dangerous lie. We insist on reminding ourselves because we love Jesus. And we have learned from him, and we have learned from his Hebrew ancestors, that new beginnings are built from the joy of hope and hopeful futures, and also the wisdom of learning from the past. The good and the bad. That is being a biblical people. New beginnings, my brothers and sisters, are wondrous, they're exciting, they're important. But as we're writing our mission statements for the glorious new future, let's go back on occasion to visit the museum. And while reminding ourselves of the radical witness that God continues to call Quakers to work at, let's not forget to occasionally have a little walk in that big room over there. That also is being a biblical